Well, so on the other end of the line is the man who wrote that song, and when you look at it, so many others, and has worked with so many artists. That man is Mike Batt. Mike, hi.
Hello, very nice to see you.
How do you even define, would you call yourself a songwriter, a composer? How would you define yourself? It's probably easier if I ask you that than try and work it out myself.
Well, I see it as really one process, even though I don't always do every one part of that process. But to me, if I think of an idea for a song, write the song, do the arrangement, produce the record, then do a deal with the record company or put it out on my own label, whatever it might be. And then sometimes it doesn't even stop there. You've then got to make sure it's promoted. Well, it doesn't ever stop there. You've got to do all of that. Sometimes you might, you know, it might be making a video. All of those things, to me, are just part of the process of creating that single or that album and carrying on with what you do. And I just enjoy all the different parts of it.
And you started really young. You started out enjoying classical music, is that right? And that's kind of always been there on the CD. We've got some of your classical examples.
Yeah, I first got hooked on classical music just before the Beatles happened. And it was the Beatles that added the popness into my life, as it were. When I was about 10, I was hooked on classical music because, you know, in those days, before the internet, you used to have things like bulb catalogues and things that all the junk mail was actually printed junk mail and they sent it through your door. One of them was Concert Hall Record Company, Record Club. And you could get three free vinyl EPs of classical music. And so free music to me was great. We never heard of it. So I got my three free EPs and then I had to compulsorily buy a whole LP. And the first LP I got was Schubert's Ninth Symphony.
Wow.
Conducted by Karl Schuricht of with the I think it was the Stuttgart Philharmonic. And I just loved it. When my parents went out on Saturday morning, we lived in Bradford, and they'd go out shopping, I would take the dining table, I put the chairs up on it and sideways to it, and put little signs saying violins, second violins, violas, horns, and I'd put it on the gramophone, as they used to call it, I'd conduct Schubert's Ninth Symphony. The furniture played it brilliantly.
But you're bringing in the various instruments at the time, so you were really starting to understand how it was all built.
Yeah, and I had to learn every little woodwind entry, and so when the oboe was coming, I would look over to that dining chair and go, and I'd coax it in. And when there was a big brass section, I'd look over to my right and punch the air, and in would come the brass. Of course, even if I didn't punch the air, it would have still come in because it was a record I was conducting.
Absolutely, but you're learning your trade, aren't you? You're really learning your trade.
Exactly.
Then you went off to a record label at 18, which, when everyone else would have been sort of just touting the guitar around, you went off to a record label. And I guess when you talk about all the different things, all the aspects of putting a tune out nowadays, you were learning your craft again. Even right back then, you were seeing how it all happens. It's not just, I want to be a pop star.
Again, it's a continuous thing. I mean, if you're interested in music, you know, you buy records. And the first record I bought was Island of Dreams by the Springfields, which a lot of people think, oh, that's not very cool. But actually, it was a wonderful record. And of course, you have that wonderful voice of Dusty Springfield on it. And you fall in love with records. In fact, I also remember one of my first records I got was when I got chucked by my girlfriend when I was 15. I went home and listened to Roy Orbison singing It's Over. And I played it over and over and over, you know, in my bedroom, being sorry for myself. And that's what I learned, the importance of lyrics, the importance of crafting a good lyric, you know, as well as a tune. So that was really just how I sort of grew up through it and to it. And yes, it did lead me to going to see record labels and trying to convince them that the rubbish songs they were listening to now would one day grow into better songs that I would write soon.
You know, and I mean, in amongst that list, you've got things like Bright Eyes, you've got A Winter's Tale. These are ones, I mean, it's kind of like, it must be your equivalent of Slade and Merry Christmas, everybody. Christmas comes every year, David Essex's A Winter Tale gets played every year, doesn't it?
It does. Yeah, it's one of those sort of supermarket perennials.
Yeah.
David Essex record. He just rang me up in 1982 and said, "Do you think you could write me a Christmas song?" And it was already about October. And I said, "David, we've hardly got any time." He said, "I don't know, but you can do it." And Tim Rice was coming around to my house the next day. I know it's a bit of a name drop, but hey. And we were going to be writing a musical together. I wanted to write about the Aztecs.
Right.
I had this idea. And I said to Tim, what about that? And he said, "So how's the rest of your life?" We went for a pint. And I said, "Oh, David rang, by the way, yesterday and said he wanted a Christmas song." He said, "Oh, let's do that." So instead of my musical, that's why you've never heard of my Aztec musical.
Is that right? Blame David Essex.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we wrote this song. We sort of co-wrote the lyric, really, because it was a very serious message I was sending to a girlfriend of mine, which it was a love that could never be, because she was in Australia and I was in England.
Oh, wow.
And so I said, "Timmy, do you mind? I hope you don't mind if I help you write this lyric." So he said, "Absolutely not. It's your story." So when he went home, I wrote, for example, the second verse and finished off the chorus. So it's kind of like a co-written lyric. And it means a lot to me, that song. Because, in fact, the girl that I wrote it about is now my wife.
Oh, really? So it wasn't the love that could ever be. It was the love that actually did wind up being the love.
Yeah, I mean, on a worldwide scale, with Just Another Winter's Tale turned out to be a big lie. So with Summertime City, they wanted an up-tempo pop song about having a good time in the summer. And so I wrote the song. Michael Hurl, the producer, he said he loved the song. The dance troupe was the new addition. They were going to be singing it. We went into the studio after I'd put the backing track down. And even though they're good singers, all of them, and dancers, great dancers, we couldn't find anyone strong enough to do the lead vocal. So as I had to deliver it the next day, I just put my own vocal on it.
Right.
And delivered it. And he said, "Oh, it's fantastic. Let's put it out." So I put it out on CBS Records. I had to deal with them anyway. And it went to number 4 in the charts. And so that was Mike Batt suddenly becomes a bubblegum pop singer.
And that's, your voice is instantly recognisable.
Well, yeah. And funny enough, of course, it's the same voice that's on all the Womble hits. So there I was being a Womble without a costume for a while. And it rather tripped me up as the sort of serious songwriter I wanted to be taken as in this country. And I'm still thought of as Mr. Womble. I don't regret it at all. We had a great time with it. My mum made the costumes, you know.
And there was a lot of hits off the back of that. And again, it's one of these things that's perennial, isn't it? The Wombles keeps coming back.
Yeah, and it was such fun to do it. And I've got a slightly overdeveloped sense of humour, I have to admit. And my mum making the costumes made it very much a family thing. I think I've inherited her. She's no longer with us, sadly, but I inherited her sort of wackiness. And I just because of the fun it gave her, I don't regret the Wombles. That's if anyone says to me, "Oh, you know, do you regret the Wombles?" I bet you do. And I think, no. Why would I?
No.
And the extra thing is that it gave my mum such a lot of fun.
Then there's the whole story, of course, of your own record label, which brought us Cara Emerald and Katie Melua. Was that, amongst many others, the Marianne Faithfuls of this world as well, was that an opportunity for you to write in a different style because those were going to be different voices and appealing perhaps to a different generation?
Well, Katie, definitely. There were two things. One, I was writing new songs for Katie, deliberately, like we mentioned. He's like, say, 9 Million Bicycles. Mm. You know, it was written directly for Katie. As were actually most of the things we did together. But then I would also find stuff from my back catalogue that I felt hadn't really had its day in the sun. And maybe 15 years ago, I'd written it and it had been an album track and a different single had been chosen. So you got this stranded song from the past. You bring it out, and I did it with Katie, and suddenly, like, for example, the first hit we had, The Closest Thing to Crazy was in fact a song which I'd recorded myself 10 years ago on a solo album, which had never come out. So it was, you know, reaching into the old treasure chest and, you know, polishing off something and making it into something new. And it was Katie's, what do you call it, interpretation of that that made it into what it was, what it became.
So how on earth, it begs the question, how on earth do you choose the tracks to go onto a, I mean, not a single greatest hits album. We've got the penultimate greatest hits, two discs. How on earth did you weed through that catalogue? Well, I'll have to have that one, but at the expense of that one.
It's very difficult when you're compiling an album, particularly of your own stuff. If it had been a single album, I don't know what I would have done, because it would have been, what are your best 12 tracks? So I made it a double CD of 36 tracks, of which two are new recordings. One is a recording of a song called It's Only Pain, which was a Katie single, which I wrote for her, actually. So that was reversing the process. Instead of her re-recording my old material, I was recording her old material.
Right.
So that's one of the new tracks on the album. But generally speaking, it's what it allowed me to do is on that, particularly on the second disc of the pair, it enabled me to put on some tracks, maybe even a couple of instrumental tracks, a couple of filmy tracks, a couple of classical standing, a couple of completely weird tracks, as well as a few curios from when I was 18 or 19.